Hello, it's good to talk to you. I'm Eben Moglen, and this is Law in Contemporary Society, wherever contemporary society may be for you right now. It's not a thing I hope to get used to after a third of a century of teaching law school in a room, to be starting another course with nobody present in my isolation booth overlooking the Hudson River, but that's what the first day of class feeling that I know so well after all these decades is turned into for the moment in the era of the epidemic. And for you, too, there is a difference of a profound and we don't exactly know yet how to characterize kind. The purpose of this course, as we shall see a little more in a moment, is to understand the role of creativity both in law school and in the lawyer's life, and of course, therefore, I feel as the maker of the thing, that it is my creativity that is first at test. The course, as I have been teaching it for 30 years now, occurs in the form of creativity that can occur in a room with people in it sitting in banked rows and something down at the bottom that might or might not be a stage. And so the conversation that I believe this experience to be made of happens under ordinary conditions of creativity in the mode of live theater with music and speeches extemporized and otherwise that fill this wooden O, as the prologue of Henry V calls it. And like that prologue, I now must ask you to imagine in your minds not the fields of France and prancing horses of war, but rather the conversation that might be happening if we were all in the same place trying to learn two things. Two streams of things, two strands of things braided together. One, what does it mean to be creative in law school? How can one use one's creativity to learn better, to enjoy learning more, and not coincidentally, but secondarily, to do well in law school? The second question that we put ourselves to thinking about in this conversation that must now occur across ether in several different modes. The second question is, how do we create lives for ourselves as lawyers once we have learned the law that will satisfy us as human beings who have lives we wish to lead with other people in society, families of whatever type, and satisfy us as material producers of the well-being of some portion of that family, earners, if you like, entrepreneurs, proprietors, business people, if you please, employees, if you must, but also what will satisfy us as citizens, as officers of courts, as people trying to make justice? What will satisfy us in all these ways, and how do we create the form of life in which, as people and as providers and as citizens and makers of justice, we will feel from day to day that our lives are being lived well? Those are the subjects of this course. I make no apology for the subjects. Law school should be about how to learn law well, not merely about learning some law. Because as lawyers over a lifetime, most of the law that you will be called upon to learn, you didn't learn in law school. Lawyers in life, as we shall see from time to time as we conduct ourselves in such a way as to listen to lawyers in life talk a lot about how what they learned about the law they didn't learn in law school. They seem to think that this is a knock on law school. I, who have plenty of things to knock on law school about, wouldn't knock this, however. It's right that most of the law that you will ever learn, you didn't learn in law school. Law school taught you how to learn law. Law school taught you how to think about law. At least it was if it bothered to get out of bed this morning. That's the easy part of law school, is teaching people how to learn law. But it's good to reflect upon it as we do it so that people will learn better, enjoy learning more, and do well. But the easy part of law school, which is the part that law school does, has a second part, a harder part, which is teaching people how to figure out what kind of lawyers to be. And law school does this very poorly. It does it poorly because it doesn't do it consciously. It teaches you how to think about what kind of lawyer to be by introducing you to lots of lawyers, by helping you build network. And this is crucial and important, and indeed, it's most of what you pay for when you pay for a law school like this one, which is so expensive, as opposed to other kinds of law school, which can teach you how to learn the law just as well. But as we shall see, it's the network that is the value. But we'll come back to that as we'll come back to all these things, because this is just the first day, and all I need to do is to unpack and set forth on the little cloth on the street what my wares are so that you can see what it is that I am offering you. It's all a little more complicated than it looks, and we shall spend a lot of time on it together, or not exactly together, but as close to together as we know how to get under current circumstances. Because indeed, this is the hard part of law school, thinking about how to be a lawyer. And the trouble is that law school doesn't do it thoughtfully. And it doesn't do it thoughtfully early enough, which is why when we set out to remake the first year curriculum in 1988 and 1989, just, well, you know, after we began to unmake the remade first-year curriculum, which mostly now, over the course of decades, we've taken back. But when we set out to figure out how to begin law school again, I, as a beginner, had some ideas about that, which turned out to be wrong, but not completely wrong, and which, over 30 years, have grown into this course we do together now in the time of the epidemic, not together, but for the same purpose that we would be doing it if we were together, which is to help you succeed. See, that's the thing about law school, is that it behaves as though it wants only some of us to succeed, and then some of us will get a job, and then there will be these other few that somehow it didn't work. And this is, of course, it's like any other nightclub that makes its money out of making you feel that some people are really beautiful, and some people get in, and some people, well, what can you say? And that's how they make their money, off the velvet rope. I, too, in that sense, must make my money off the velvet rope, because I must participate in law school to the extent that I don't oppose it. Otherwise, what would be the point of teaching in it? But I'm not the guy running the velvet rope. I'm the one who thinks that everybody should come in. And some people should decide that it's not what they want to do, and they should be free to go and do something else without feeling that they're failures. And everybody else should succeed. That would be, from my point of view, an effective institution. One which helps people to know how to love the law and which honors deeply those who turn out not to love the law and do not need to stay, and makes all those who can learn to love the law effective, powerful, capable not only of changing the society, but of deciding how they want to live while they do what they want to make it change. That's the great privilege before you. And it's not surprising that in order to exploit that privilege fully and to do good and live well and to come down where you ought to be in this profession, it's helpful to have help. And the help in a school consists of help with learning things, known, generally speaking, as teaching, and here known as professing, though whether one is really a law professor or a law teacher is a subject upon which I remain somewhat doubtful. But in any event, the goal is success in learning. And learning here is defined as the learning one does in law school, how to learn the law joyfully and effectively and powerfully, and even more, how to learn to be a lawyer. Not anybody's lawyer, not every kind of lawyer, not the kind of lawyer who can be found by using a can opener to open a can of tinned meat called Lawyers Within, and unpack them into one's establishment and set them up, each can on its end, each end on a chair, each chair next to a desk, each desk billing some hours. I mean, it's okay if you want to be meat in a can and to be opened in a factory that consumes canned meat, because one day you will be a four-person and later you will run the factory. It's okay with me. I have no trouble with that. But I do have a trouble. And the trouble is that over a third of a century teaching here and in other similarly fine law schools, I have taught thousands of people who went out to do that, and by and large, they turned out not to be happy. And year by year, that weighed on me a little more as more and more of my students went out into the world and were unhappy in practice. And many of them left the law. And others of them left their sposi and their families and tried to start again and weren't happy a second time. And many had some money, which they would have traded for some happiness, but they kept trying to trade that money for happiness, and all they wound up with was better vehicles or more expensive real estate. And this is not what I think our art is for. I think our art is to improve society by making justice and to ennoble in their own hearts those who do it. That's what I think the art is for. And although that might sound better in the theater if we were all there together face to face, and it may sound a little goofy or smarmy to you right now, wherever it is that the epidemic makes you live, I still believe it. Not only in the sense that I think it would be nice if my students could feel that way, but because I myself also, as a lawyer with a practice, feel that way. I have done things that were good. and I have tried to make better justice in the ways that I thought particularly possible for me, and I have enjoyed that. And so it isn't merely that I want to teach you to do something I wouldn't do myself, which God knows we do pretty well in law school, which is full of people who will teach you how to go and practice large law firm law that they wouldn't themselves want to do because they're here doing this instead. I want to help you succeed at doing something I also wanted to succeed at, which is finding a way to be the lawyer that you want to be, whose work you consider to be adequately admirable and adequately remunerative and adequately sustaining, that you can live a happy and fulfilling life while doing it. And now the question is how to make any progress towards that goal that could be said to be reliable when you are in the second term in law school. Not too early, God knows. By now, as you can see, it is possible to be demoralized by law school and to be unhappy about the prospects that it seems to open to you while you feel like you must continue doing it. Already you know that that's a possible outcome, and by God it is, and I want to fight with all our heart and soul against anybody's reaching that outcome because I'm tired of it. It's common, and it's unfortunate, and it's wrong. But how to avoid it? So the first thing that we need to understand is law school, which is not all that hard, but requires at least a little bit of critical distance from its own account of itself. The part of law school you have just finished going through, its first sixth, its storied first semester, the thing that gives 1L and the paper chase their savor, the thing that you've just been through is a form of language learning by immersion. Those of you who have taken foreign language by immersion will have recognized some of the structures and the symptoms. You get one term of intensive, immersive training in comprehension and conversation in law talk, and it works. The principle, like the principle of learning German or French or Mandarin by immersion, the principle is to face you with an environment full of the new language and empty of the old one, in which, by virtue of the force from the fire hose, the sheer flow of the language that you are trying to acquire, your brain is forced to wire itself up for the comprehension of, and even more frighteningly, the reproduction of the target language, because there isn't anything else. It's a form of learning that depends upon sensory deprivation, effective but undesirable. Nonetheless, with respect to language acquisition, it works. Better before puberty, which is why smaller human beings pick up new languages very, very rapidly when they are simply dropped into new linguistic environments, but after puberty, somewhat more painfully and with more difficulty, like everything else after puberty. Language immersion produces ultimately linguistic mastery. And the way that it functions means that after a particularly disorienting and painful beginning, in which every form of meaning is hard wrung from the environment by constant use of the most sophisticated and calorically intensive parts of the brain. All that processing cycles, heating up, trying to decode what's coming in moment by moment, syllable by syllable, word by word. There comes a moment when, for the first time, you wake from sleep aware that you were dreaming in the new language. A crucial moment in the process of becoming a speaker, in which conscious reasoning effort, cryptanalysis, decoding, is no longer going on in the most conscious and most highly sophisticated and most fallible part of the brain and of the secretion it calls the mind. Now, unconsciously, in dream life, without consciousness, the language has already occupied enough neural stacks that it can not only be decoded, but it can be produced in dream. With this turning point process, which was described to me before I went to law school by Morty Horowitz as the light going on. At this turning point in the process, when the light goes on, you become linguistically capable of law talk. And each of you can locate, no doubt, somewhere in the course of the fall turned winter in this epidemic law school you began, when that happened to you. Well, one of the outcomes of this is that the grades that you receive, which are allegedly telling you all about what you have done in the first part of law school, are nothing of the kind. They all measure the same thing, which is why, after decades of teaching second semester students and reading first semester transcripts, thousands of them, I can tell you that for almost every law student, plus or minus one half grade, all the grades you get in the first semester of law school are the same. Because, in fact, these supposedly helpful measures of performance measure only a single question, which is, when did the light go on? How quick were you at acquiring neural machinery for unconscious understanding and reproduction of law talk? If it happened in October, you got A's. If it happened in November, you got B's. This is a meaningless measurement. The grade is a fallacy of mensuration personified, that what can be counted is what counts. Over 70 years of being a lawyer, it will not matter to you when, in the fall of 2020, the light went on. It's a meaningless question. But right now, it seems like everything, because it's the thing being told you, is important, because it's embodied in the things that matter, which are the grades. I have asked you to read my evaluation policy, and if you haven't done so already, I must ask you once again to read it. Everybody must know how it works. But here I will only begin by pointing out that this is why not only are grades stupid, but first semester law school grades are particularly stupid. They are a reproduction of a single, rather unimportant measurement transposed, apotheosized into words from the Lord God about whether you're any good or not. And they stink. But whatever it is that they tell you about the timing of your acquisition of adequate neural complexity to manage law talk unconsciously, it's happened now. The second semester of law school is not about that anymore. Having taken aboard the language, the second semester of law school is the time when two other questions then arise, one of which is, what is this culture I have joined that speaks this language? And the other one of which is, what does this matter to me? Which produces, as I say, the two questions that are now before us that we wish in this course to deal with, one of which is, how do I be creative in law school? In other words, how do I, as a person being acculturated to the law, cease or never actually turn out to be merely a passive recipient of culture? How do I bring aboard my own capacity to produce new culture, the thing we call creativity, the meaning of being human, actually? How do I turn that on in law school? Now that I know this language, how do I begin to use it to create, not merely to reproduce? And who will I be in this culture I am joining, for which I have paid a lot of money and to which I am now indebted? Who will I be here in this place? Surely not merely someone working in a salt mine. I needn't pay if I want to work in a salt mine. And therefore, when we turn the first stretch turn in law school from the first term of the first year into the second, everything has become different. To possess another language is to possess another soul. And yet, ensoulment having happened, law school continues to go on just as before. There isn't any apparent difference between what goes on in the semester one and the semester five. Or two. And this is very confusing and, in fact, contributes to the intellectual deracination and demoralization that can occur in law school, because, by God, it ought to change. There should be some way that we should know from the way that others behave around us that we have come into another portion of our time, and the questions, how do I make culture and how do I live well in my new life, are agitating. So now we understand the contribution that law school makes to what must happen next. Under ordinary circumstances, this contribution is negative. Law school refuses to admit that anything has changed. You've gone from semester one into semester two, and the primary messages and these grades are even more important. That's just cosmetics. That's the makeup. It's not even the costuming, let alone the lighting, let alone the script, let alone the meaning of the play. But there's a positive consequence, too. You are newly empowered. You are beginning to read the literature of this new culture and to think about the marks you mean to make in it. It would be a terrific time to begin systematically understanding what that means for you. Law school has created the opportunity. It doesn't help. But you needn't throw it away. So here we are. How do we do this? Well, from an operational point of view, we do this by reading and writing together. What we need to read isn't the material of Law Talk itself. You have fine other courses for that, and that is the way in which law school refuses to admit that anything has changed and bully for law school. What we need to read, in my opinion, and my opinion matters here because I've done this so many times more than you have. That's the only reason that it matters. In my opinion, what we need to do is to learn what the ideas are within which law school operates. American lawyers are really quite different in the world from other lawyers. Late in the 19th century, Americans began thinking about law in an unusual way, which they came to call realism, which is the word usually applied to a way of thinking when it's unusual and unpopular. It means to emphasize that it is realer than that which it hopes to transcend. But American legal realism is good realism. It's not merely well-named realism, it's realism with a purpose, with a way of relating law to the real, which is importantly special. Exposure to American realist law thought, which you can't avoid because American law school is taught in a realist fashion, though it doesn't necessarily explain itself that way. Exposure to American legal realism is helpful. It helps to provide a basis for creativity in law. And by focusing on what lawyers do, by focusing in general upon what things do, by declaring as its basic fundamental principle about the world that things are what they do, not what they're called, realist American law thought has the benefit of being about lawyering. We will, in this course, depend very heavily upon a definitional understanding of lawyering. And oddly enough, we won't need to have or even attempt to construct, in that sense, a definitional understanding of what law is. Lawyering here, today, tomorrow, 12 weeks from now, 12 weeks imitating 14 weeks. Today, tomorrow, 12 weeks from now, lawyering in this class means making things happen in society using words. Lawyering, which is done mostly but not entirely by lawyers, lawyering is making things happen in society using words. Other people, too, make things happen in society using words, and every time we meet someone making things happen in society using words, we're meeting a sister or a brother. So part of what we read in here is material from siblings about making things happen in society using words. Poets do that. Novelists do that. Journalists do that. Advocates of not a lawyer kind, but a social kind, a political kind, a commercial kind, do that. I won't go so far as to say that Instagram influencers do that, because I think they don't, but it's an important subject of discussion in the corner of what we're about to do. What we are about to do is to begin to understand, then, lawyering, even more than law, on a basis which starts from the proposition that when we want to understand social phenomena, we understand what they do first, before we worry about what they're called. That gets dicey sometimes, even a little uncomfortable, as it should. We are social animals, we human beings are. We shall spend a bunch of time thinking about what that means, that we humans are social animals. And therefore, we can be a little bit uncomfortable in our awareness of society. Gifted as we are, unlike the other social animals, the termites, let us say, or the wasps, gifted as we are with just painfully sensitive self-consciousness, deeply involved at all times in the secretion and braiding of the thing we call self, and often discombobulated at a organism level by having to understand just how damn social we are. But be that as it may, we're going to go for it. Try to understand, in other words, where lawyering comes from in society, just as the thinkers about law in the United States in the late 19th century, coping with the meaning of the ideas of that we call Darwin, had to do. So we'll spend a few weeks trying to understand the evolution over decades of a way of thinking about law and society in the United States, which produced, by the time of the Second World War, an unusual form of thinking about law in the societies of the human race. Not absolutely unique, but very different from the surrounding intellectual systems that evolved from the Roman law in Europe and that took their rise from other systems of traditional thinking about law in the big world. And we'll spend some time thinking about how to have a theory of social action for lawyers. And we'll consider the mechanisms of argument and evidence and proof that best arrange themselves in a theory of social action for lawyers. And how, well, to get, you know, specific about it, you could put it in the blue books next time around. What it would mean to be really good at thinking about law in law school, as well as learning the law being taught to you in the course in which the blue book is presented to you for you to put your wisdom in. How to have a better quality of wisdom, maybe. Or at least a quality of wisdom that you more enjoy putting in the blue books. In order to do this, as I say, what we need is not the material of the law, but the material around the law. And so what we read isn't cases, and it isn't statutes, and it isn't regulations. Some of it is fiction about lawyers, more truthful than truth, in a way, I hope. Some of it is to think about ourselves, that is, human beings, in the various ways, intrapsychically, social psychologically, anthropologically, sociologically, historically, and philosophically, that thinking about people the way we are helps us to understand how to make things happen in society using words, allows us to put our theory of social action into something we call practice. And along the way, we also need to think about what this is teaching us about how to be lawyers, each of us a different lawyer. We're trying to create ideas about law. When those ideas are yours, when you feel like taking them on and moving their limbs and making them speak, you will write essays about these ideas. Two of them. Two essays, I mean, each an idea, never longer than 1,000 words at any time, for any reason, in at least two drafts each. This is a kind of working on thinking about the law, the goal of which is your success at learning how to write about a legal idea in less than 1,000 words. That might make something happen in society by turning into a newspaper op-ed or a letter, or it might be one component of a brief or a component of a series of briefs, or it might be a litigation campaign, because anything that we make in order to make a thing happen in society using words, every lawyer's writing is purposive, fulfills a purpose, has a reason. Anything a lawyer writes can be thought of as written in units of 1,000 words. Architectural elements piled, shaped, interwoven. So the unit of writing, the 1,000-word unit, edited, partly by me, partly by others in the class, partly by you, but for the purpose, ultimately, of making you a better editor of your own writing, because lawyers don't file the first draft. Everything a lawyer makes has been made more than once. That's to avoid malpractice, in one sense, to achieve better effectiveness, in another sense. And because lawyers live in society, they have people to whom they are responsible called clients, and they have people with whom they work who are supervisors, and they have people with whom they work who are colleagues, and their language develops and improves, or at least changes, is modified by the experience of touching other minds. One of the best litigators I ever worked with taught me something important when I worked with him on a case. We were quite independent functionaries, but I got a chance to listen to him talking to the client whom I had brought to him. And I learned from him an important trick or practice or meaning of our work. Because whenever he circulated a draft of a brief or some other object to be filed, he would send it to the client with a reminder pinned on the top, and he would say, "Every word will change." And his habit, which I thought of in the beginning as like other elements of his titanic vanity, was not. It was a truthful recapitulation of the fact of lawyers' writing. Every word will change. So it's editing, that process by which one knows why words should change and what they should say when they change into something else. Editing, which is the crucial activity of lawyers' writing, and yet in law school, well, as you know, you're lucky if there is even the possibility of rethinking. Usually the writing is done after the course is over. And the quality of editing, that's important too. We'll see later in the course in more detail a lawyer I knew at the beginning of my life as a lawyer, a cravath partner at the time after many other distinguished activities in a lawyer's life, and this man, let's call him Fritz because that was his name, Fritz had a habit which was both endearing to me and maddening to the associates who actually had to work with him. He would receive in the evening or late at night or when everybody was dog-tired a draft of something to be filed down the line, and he would send it back in the morning after thinking about it in the cab on the way down, and he would write across the top of it, "Make this better," and he would give it to the troops, and they would go and make it better. And of course, that's not the total amount of Fritz's skill as an editor. He had better editorial characteristics than that in him, but as a supervisor of lawyers, he considered that to be sufficient. And it is, after all, in a way, if you're a really good lawyer working for him, make this better. And so we should learn how to make this better in a thoughtful way. Hence, law school should be about rewriting and editing things, and mostly it is not. But together we will do two things, in two drafts at least, and those things, those essays, those will be your ideas, not mine, yours, not my questions, your questions. And the quality of the questions, well, that's what really matters. And the quality of the editing, that's what matters next. And the thing gets better. That's what matters in the grade. In addition to that kind of writing, which is the formal kind, the work kind of the class, there are many other kinds of writing and some other kinds of talking. There's your journal. That's where I learn from you how your learning is going. That's where you record in whatever way you want to record what is happening to you in the course, where you can ask a question or make a statement about your learning that will help me to do my work better by helping you to enjoy your learning more. The journals are private. You and I are the only people who will see them, each of you and all of me. The essays you may make private if you wish, but more helpfully, they can be public. You can see more than 1,000 of them out on the wiki written by people in the past and see what I said, what they said, how they changed it. It's all there behind the history button on each page in the wiki, which is the third most important button on each page. Looking at the history of a page tells you how editing worked on it, how an idea changed in the course of editing. It gives you a way of thinking about other people's thoughts and maybe helps you with your own. And that's all there, and you can see it because other people decided to share it in the past, and this is why you might also be wise to be sharing it yourself. The second most important button on the page is the one that says New Topic, which means that you can always make not just a new topic, but a new part of our course by asking something. Presenting an idea, operating a question, issuing a concept, punching a ticket, doesn't matter. You hit the new topic button and you say a thing and we find out what happens. Twice a week, on Monday and Wednesday afternoons, we do that on a form of collaborative writing system called an etherpad. The class, unlike the one unrolling in a sequential style in the Zoom school, where color blocks on the screen interact with one another in, quote, real time being recorded, the etherpad is where we actually all write at the same time together. I'll get there first and set some ideas about what we might write about up and leave lots of room because the pad is infinitely long. And then we'll chat, as the technological the jargon has it, about all those things in togetherness with a transcript since everything we are saying to one another, we are writing down and leaving where we can find it later, except for the trivial, you know, stuff that we don't want to save. And this, our immediate writing, our live writing, our talking back and forth using written words on a shared web page, part of our writing, is how we feel from moment to moment, not overnight, that we're connected with one another. And then there's the single most important button on every page, which is the edit button up on the top right-hand side with the little green background that says go. Because everything we do, we can all do together. We can edit anything that we can see. And we can make changes and proposals and have conversations back and forth and then refactor the page, that is, take all that back and forth and summarize it and explain what it is that we think we've come to by way of consensus on the basis of our conversation. And so in each of these different interactive structures, the private journal, the polished essay being edited, the topics being suggested by the reading and the talking as we go, the live dialogue on the page, on the pad, we find ways of making things happen in our little society using words. And of course, there's these words of mine, this talking. In general, I will publish a talk on Sunday in case you want to spend Sunday evening listening and thinking about how you might want to handle it on the etherpad on Monday, what you might want to ask, what you have to say, what you want to call attention to in the wiki, etc. And maybe I'll put something out on Tuesday before our Wednesday conversation based on what I think has happened on the Monday pad, and maybe I won't. And my talking is, of course, an introduction to what I think reading I have assigned from the preceding week might mean, and where I think we might go next, and what I hope you might be inclined to think about. But it's just me. I have a role here. I'm the one with the lawyer's license. I'm the one with decades in law school, whatever that may be good for. I'm the one trying to set a good example creating as I go, with whatever inherent limits my creativity may impose upon me. I'm good at this, I'm bad at that. And after all, I don't know how to work with you yet, because we've never played in a band together before. And we need to take some steps to figure out, in that sense, who we are and how to play well together. But sometimes, I'll just start pounding it out on the piano and you get to come along as best you can. I've tried to explain in Why Not Video Conferencing, an essay in the wiki that I will once again say I need you to read. I've tried to explain in Why Not Video Conferencing why this isn't a course offered in Zoom school. I spent years trying to figure out how to teach law school when, as was inevitably going to occur, we wound up, for reasons of climate change or epidemic, unable to convene law school in person. This became clear to me as an inevitability when, in the fall of 2012, Hurricane Sandy hit New York at the beginning of the fall term, and I happened to be away attending the wedding of my law partner in India, and couldn't come back to New York for 10 days, and there was a great deal of chaos in the law school, as so many of my colleagues were caught offside. And sitting in the hotel in New Delhi, I realized that this was a dress rehearsal of a tiny kind, and that I should figure out how to deal with it the next time, which apparently was an idea that was not borne in upon all my colleagues at the same time, because 7.5 years later, when the dress rehearsal turned up in full armor, we were caught quite unaware, and people went and decided that video conferencing is good and they should use it for everything, and we became Zoom school, and that was wrong. As we will all see as this course goes along, I'm a person who thinks in historicist and lawyer-like, but also in computerized terms. I started working as a professional computer programmer when I was 14 years old in 1973. I've spent almost a half a century programming computers and making them do things using words. So my attitudes about technology may be different, but they're well informed. And I started working with video conferencing technology late in the 20th century, and it was no good then, and it isn't good now. And so the way we use words will be in forms that don't involve this synchronous video conferencing, but what the epidemic has taught me is that once everybody is separated as much as we are now separated, even though people are zoomed out, even though their minds are rejecting all this video conferencing, even though neurologically speaking it is disappointing them and neurosocially it is crushing them nonetheless, people yearn for human connection. And if you offer them the opportunity to talk with pictures, they will take it. So we will do some video conferencing in this course too, but never as a way of supporting primary learning. We will have office hours on video conference, and we will have small group discussion for remote students on video conference about the same time that we can begin to meet one another masked face to masked face, socially distanced in Riverside Park, when things get just a little better in New York City than they are going to be in January and early February. And we will use video conferencing that is private and that is secret from the Chinese Communist Party and the American listeners and the commercial interests of the data mining companies and so on, because I care a lot about privacy and a lot about the use of technology to support freedom, which is a bunch of the work I do, lawyering in life and teaching in law school, and all our technology will be technology we control. I control mostly, but you control partially, and nobody else controls at all. So when we do our video conferencing, we'll use my server, not Zoom server, and so on and so on. All of which will become clear enough to you, probably tediously clear enough to you, when from time to time my ideas turn up in the flow of our ideas. That is, the things I care about, not only to help you be creative in law school and to help you figure out what kind of lawyer you are, but to do that by showing what ideas I care about and what kind of lawyer they made me. In this place, I have opinions, and I'll express them just as you should express yours, the purpose of which is not to indoctrinate anybody into anything. I don't think of a poem as a work of indoctrination, no matter how self-confident and even dictatorial the poem may be. It's still a poem. It wants us to read it, to hear it, to consider it. But if it tried to run the reader, it wouldn't be a poem anymore. And so, this is a class. Its purpose is revolution. There's no doubt about that. The revolution, however, is in your head to free your mind, to help you function more completely as yourself, to be liberated as a lawyer, because a liberated lawyer is one dangerous thing. And if it could be the case that liberated lawyers could be produced by law school, then something would have to happen in the second term of law school that would help them to get there. Like my teacher, William Blake, as I go about, when I used to go about, when going about was possible in my society, mind-forged manacles I heard everywhere clanking. And I know that mind-forged manacles, unlike chains of steel, are made slowly. They grow on us rather than merely being fastened there in a moment. The manacles that I hear clanking on the limbs of the lawyers I have taught over a third of a century grew around them beginning just now. Just at the moment when, having mastered law talk, they entered into the culture. Not in bondage, but not yet as free people either. Newly landed, speaking a new tongue, feeling new possibilities, and too often carrying great new loads of debt. But what it was that happened, beginning just about where you are now, is that they accepted limitations tacitly, often unconsciously. Limitations which came as information. The way it is, what it's like, what you do, how this works. Produced in mandatory meetings that were really optional, but people didn't know they didn't have to go. People didn't know you can't make a lawyer go, not without a court order. Moments where people accepted that being a lawyer will not be what I thought it was going to be when I came here, but something different, more wealthy maybe, but less in some other way, that there are trade-offs, sacrifices, realistic goals that you must have, things that happen when you go to Columbia Law School, good in one way, bad in another, but at any rate, you should get set to be what so many others have. That was the landing site for the beginning of the electrode deposition, the growing bit by bit under electromagnetic forces of the deposition of the molecules of steel. Not too much longer, and you could see the braiding of the chains begin, the cuffs and Then the gold plating begins to be applied, and pretty soon, well, we shall meet the people. We shall talk to them, we shall listen. That we have the advantage, as everybody after Dante had the advantage. You could go below and listen to the experience of the damned. So we'll do that, too. All for the purpose of making it just a little more possible that 12 weeks from now, you'll have figured out how to be more creative in law school. And the blue books will suddenly blossom with your ideas. And you'll start thinking about planning your practice, which is the name of another of my courses. And maybe you'll even want to think about planning your practice rather than letting law school plan your trajectory. But that's what lies ahead. I hope it works well for you. Talk to you soon.